Welcome to Better Cybersecurity, the ISF podcast. I'm your host, Steve Durbin.
ISF Chief Executive Steve Durbin is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today's guest is Dr. Keith Morneau, an experienced cybersecurity professional who currently serves as Dean of Computer and Information Science at ECPI University. Steve and Keith discuss the future of the cyber workforce, cyber education, and if AI is taking our jobs. Steve also asks Keith to step into the shoes of a CEO.
So in the boardroom today, we very much talk about cyber risk as if it's some kind of technical issue. In the SOC, we talk about it as if it's some kind of data problem. But at its core, fundamentally, cybersecurity is, I believe, and always will be, a people problem. Joining me on the podcast today is Dr. Keith Morneau. He is the Dean of Computer and Information Science at ECPI University. And Keith is something of a pioneer in experiential learning and a leading voice on the AI augmented professional. Now, he doesn't just teach people how to code, he teaches them how to think, how to adapt, and how to lead in an era that he calls the third disruption of technology. As an academic leader, technologist, and learning architect, he spent more than three decades transforming how students and professionals engage with technology. His career bridges education, cybersecurity, software engineering, and workforce innovation with a deep commitment to building learning environments that prepare people not just for jobs, but for purposeful professional lives. So today, we're going to find out why your next great security hire might be a nurse, why AI might be the best thing to ever happen to your junior staff, and indeed how to build a workforce that's resilient enough to survive the next decade. Welcome to the show, Keith.
Thank you.
Now, you've worked as a cyber educator for more than 20 years. What are the biggest differences in cyber education between what and how you teach it today and when you actually began working?
Really, I began doing cybersecurity pretty much before 1998,
okay,
when we were really dealing with systems and we're dealing with configurations mostly. So tools and configuration really the big thing back then. Now the complexity has increased to a point where not only you have to understand systems, but you have to understand them deeply enough to be able to understand how they all interact and how the networks work, how the cyber and how the AI is actually interacting with your systems and all that stuff. That has radically changed. So it went from pretty much people working and doing things now today, and AI has gotten to a point where it's the automation. Intelligent automation is a lot of different. It's really radically changing how things are going now.
So what essentials remain at that heart of sort of skillful cybersecurity, no matter how technology changes? What's remained constant, if you like?
Well, I think the fundamentals are still the same.
Right.
You still have to understand about computers, still understand about networks, still got to understand about how all the networks interact with each other and how the systems work together, how servers and how clusters work and cloud stuff. The fundamentals aspect of it is really important. And one of the things I think sometimes we lose fact that it lose focus on is that we're thinking that AI is going to replace all that stuff. And I'm like going, no, it's making it more complex. The problems are much more complex and the people who are having to solve those problems have to understand the systems a lot better than they probably have in the past.
I'm glad you mentioned AI so early on in the conversation because everybody talks about it today, right? You can't do anything without somebody dropping AI into the mix. And I think that certainly for a lot of people that I talk to, there's this, let me call it just an assumption, that it's going to boost the professional's productivity by a certain percentage.
Right.
So for a CEO listening to this, who's looking at an ever-increasing security budget, does this really mean that we can eventually hire fewer people? Or does the increased speed of AI-driven attacks mean we need the same headcount just operating in a different way? What's your perspective on that?
Perspective is this, that the research is showing that AI is actually improving productivity about 40%.
Right.
So you might need less people using AI effectively. If they use it effectively, augment what they're doing, they should be able to accomplish a lot more. The challenge is most of these cybersecurity professionals are overworked, or have been overworked forever.
Yeah.
So AI actually might lessen their load a bit. And if it's done right, AI should actually help your business, underlying business fundamentals, and actually allow you to grow. I can give you examples of local people here that have told me that they use AI, and it has increased their productivity so much that they're actually able to see, and in one case, the doctor's office, able to see about 30% more patients every day than they were before AI. So to give you kind of an idea.
Yeah, I get it from that perspective, the AI perhaps taking notes and that kind of thing, particularly in the medical environment. I get that. One of the challenges I'm always faced with, though, when I talk to people, is this productivity boost for mainstream business. Very often people will say to me, I've had to invest a significant amount of money in AI. It comes with a whole heap of other problems that relate to governance and policies and all of this kind of thing. And I'm not seeing that sort of kick in terms of the return on investment. How patient do people have to be? And what are some of the tips that you can share in terms of how to get a faster return?
We're really still in the baby steps of the AI in the beginning stages of it. What I've noticed is a lot of folks, there's AI there, but they're not 100% understanding how it all works, how the AI actually has to be trained and all that. I think over time, what we'll see is the increase in knowledge and skill set using AI for what they're doing in their jobs should help with the bottom line over time. But right now, we're still in a lot of ways. I talked to lots of folks outside of here. And they're still really, I would consider novices. And we've got to get them beyond that, get them to understand how they can use those tools with the troubleshooting they're doing and the work they're actually doing and everything else in a different way. And I don't think they're there yet on that aspect. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And I've got a sort of a follow-up to that as well, which is a sort of concern that I have in some organizations where this concept that AI can perhaps do away with some more junior level jobs because large language models are very good at things like log analysis, aren't they? Basic reporting, that kind of thing. And the concern that raises, I think, is how do we then provide some of that necessary on the job training for some of that entry level staff or lower down in terms of their experience? So that they can eventually become the senior leaders that we desperately need. Is there not a gap that we're creating, do you think?
Yeah, I believe so. And the way we're addressing it here is that we see AI in three different areas. We see AI is integrated in teaching and learning and having the AI actually act as coaches to the students and help them. So, for instance, they're working on a ticket as an example, or and there's a specific problem they're looking at. The AI can actually help guide them through how to figure out where the issues may happen and that stuff. So the entry level person is going to be able to use AI to actually make them smarter faster, I guess is a good word. That's one aspect. The other aspect is AI augmentation, is we got to teach the entry level folks how to use the AI to augment what they're going to do and how to use it to ask the right questions. So for instance, if you're dealing with a cloud environment, to create a user, one of the cloud environments, and you're not sure how to do that, you go to the AI and ask the AI, hey, how do I go about doing this? And AI provides you basically the step-by-step instructions on how to do that. And in some cases, really even guide you through that. So in a lot of ways, so what we're seeing is on the entry level side, we really have to teach our students to be able to use those environments so they can actually be productive and also using it so they can augment what they're doing and also learn a lot quicker than maybe they were before because they have it available to them 24 by 7. Before, if they were stuck on something, they got stuck in a mire and they did a Google search and it took them a long time to figure it out. Now they just go to AI and ask, hey, how do I do this? And it will take an assistant guide them.
Okay, I've got a question for you there because some of the critics of AI will say, hold on a minute. Are we not now teaching people not to think for themselves? If we can just ask AI a question, are we not somehow preventing people from learning how to figure things out better for themselves and losing some of that basic human processing of figuring out problems and coming up with solutions?
Yeah, honestly, I believe AI is going to increase the critical thinking skills that you're going to need to have to be able to use it. AI is doesn't act in a vacuum. It's going to act with you to do stuff. It's going to act almost like your assistant in some ways. But if you don't have the full understanding and not to know how to solve problems and how to critically think, how to adapt, how to make judgment calls based on what you're getting, that is a different type of skill set than I think we've had maybe in the past. So hey, it might do the mundane stuff. So, like for instance, you're coding something and you may be able to do simple stuff, but you got to be able to look at what generated for you and determine whether or not it's going to fit in the bigger system that you're going to be using. It's made me smarter because I can actually go to the AI and actually do some collaboration with it. I also could ask it, say, hey, here are some of my ideas that I have. Do you have anything that I'm missing? So, we just got to teach the students are going to have to be taught how to think, how to look at what they're doing, and actually create the right questions into the AI so they can get the right results out. I'm not sure if that makes sense, but that's my take on this.
No, it does make sense, Keith. I think I'd describe it as teaching people how to keep the human in the loop
Correct.
so that you're not outsourcing. What you're
Right.
doing is collaborating.
It was an organization that long ago decided, oh, we're just going to fire all our software developers. And that did not turn out well. because the AI not able to act by itself. Somebody has to direct it. So in a lot of ways, it's called orchestration. They have to understand how to use the AI to orchestrate the system that they're actually underneath it. And they can't do that. The AIs cannot do that. The human has to be able to still be able to have to do that.
Now, one important part of working in cyber today is being able to communicate technical cyber matters to people within the organization who don't have a technical background, and some might say don't have a technical interest. What's your approach to this vital skill as a cyber educator? How do you overcome that?
So every class that we teach here, we do projects quite a bit often, not necessarily in the lower level class, but as we get up into the higher level class, every single project requires them to look at the requirements are, figure out what the architecture is going to be, and be able to communicate that out. So we have them do presentations, and we actually evaluate their presentations that they do, and we'll actually critique them as they're doing their presentation. So the communication skills is now much more important than it was probably in the past, even more important. From the educator perspective, I'm trying to get them up at front and do more and more presentations, more and more talking to their audiences and asking them questions and making sure that they can actually talk about what they're actually presenting. So we do that quite a bit in almost every project that we actually have our students work on, we have them do that.
So it's really teaching them, I suppose, to take, on the one hand, to be working with the technology, we've talked about AI already, but also then be able to communicate that, translate that, using verbal skills, communication skills, so that you can bridge the gap that I've just highlighted. That's really interesting. One of the other things I wanted to ask you about, you've successfully transitioned people from nursing background and the military into cyber. We talk a lot about skill shortage in our industry. For a chief information security officer, what are the specific sort of battle-tested traits, if you like, from these non-technical fields that can actually translate better to, say, risk management or threat hunting and that kind of thing?
It's funny because I find that I can teach somebody with an ARC background to be a coder because they're using a part of their mind that's similar to what they would actually write for code. Mm-hmm. I'm also finding that, for instance, nurses could be decent technologists because they communicate with their patients every day. They have a level of understanding. Do those communication skills are good. Also, teachers are actually kind of an interesting group. We have this bachelor program here, and one of the things I've noticed that the teachers do extremely well, people that have an arts type background, performing arts type stuff too. It's interesting to see because their minds seem to work a little bit similar to how you need to be to work in this field. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of cases, that's how the transition occurs. It's easier that way, I'm finding with those types of students.
Okay, I can see that. I can relate to that. My background is in the arts rather than anything else. And so I've been a little surprised at how I've been able to grasp some of the security concepts. I'm going back a little while now. I've been doing this for a while. But certainly in the beginning, I found it probably a little bit daunting because it wasn't the kind of area that I was used to working in. And I think that's one of the challenges that the industry faces, probably on two sides. On the CISO side, where there's a tendency to want people to hire people who can tick every single box. And then on the applicant side, trepidation that perhaps you're not going to understand some of these things. And that really isn't necessarily the case. And indeed, you've proven that career switchers can become functional in a very short space of time. I think in something like a year. How do you do that? What's the magic sauce for that?
Almost every class that we teach now has a hands-on component to it. Right. So there's an experiential component, learning component that we do in everything. So not only are we teaching them the theory and the concepts and actually learning, helping them get their certifications, but we're also teaching them the actual practical aspects of how to do the work. It's the labs that we do with them. So I have a kind of a philosophy. We use something called prepare, practice, perform, assess. Mm-hmm. And so practice, we give them step-by-step instructions to do things. Performance, okay, hey, let's go ahead and use all those skills you learned and let's apply it in a much bigger fashion. And then we assess to see how well they do. And then these are skill assessments. So we're not only trying to take certifications, but we're also wanting to understand how we go to assess them skill-wise. So that's every class that we have. I don't think we have a class anymore that doesn't have some sort of experiential learning component in it now. It's trying to provide those real-world problems for them to work through. And of course, it's got to be stationed at the level they're at. So they're like really beginners. It's like vocabulary is a big issue. Language is a big issue. So we got to get them to understand the language and the vocabulary first. As they progress, we really start getting into applying what they're learning and the theory that they're learning in a practical sense.
Right. Now, people listening to this might say, well, look, that's fine for Keith to say that because he's got an educational environment. How can a business shift? So it's a whole sort of HR policy, perhaps, from, you know, searching for unicorns, perfect candidate, it really doesn't exist, to building some of these skill sets internally? What are some of the things that you think a business could do to do that?
Well, I'm really a big proponent of apprenticeships when possible. So if you are having it in like an IT environment or a cybersecurity environment, you want one of your employees to learn that, shadowing them and getting them in at the very basic level, and then we're having them work through that is one of the best ways to get somebody ready in a regular environment.
Are there any examples that you could give us of organizations that you don't need to name the organization, but where they've actually adopted that?
So there was a young lady at one time, basically was an administrative assistant and had this big IT department and everything else. And she just over time just started picking things up and starting interacting with the IT folks as they were fixing things. And she just slowly but surely learned everything she needed to learn to be able to do the work. And over time, she transitioned over to doing that work. You can actually learn a lot faster if you're actually shadowing and working, and people have to be willing to allow that to occur, though. That's one example I've seen in the past work pretty well. So they're in the environment and they're immersed in this stuff. You hear these things all the time. It's just helping them understand how all these things are applied and used.
A lot of that comes down to the individual's interest, doesn't
Correct.
it? And their own
Yes.
motivation. I'm just thinking about my own organization. We have somebody who is actually in our HR department, who has technical interest, who is gradually migrating into being a sort of technical support in the office, obviously then working with the tech teams and that kind of thing to gradually build understanding before progressing down the route that you've just suggested.
In a lot of ways, too, they have to go home and they have to be willing to do research and look at stuff and do that. And one of the beautiful things about AI, you actually go in and actually get to pretty quickly now. I mean, you can learn things a lot faster than you probably could in the past. But they have to be really wanting to do that in a way and then spend the time that it requires to do that. In some cases, I've noticed quite a few techies these days will have their own lab environments at home, as an example. Sometimes when I talk to potential folks that are going to teach, I talk to them and they say, "Oh yeah, I have this lab environment." I know they're going to be great teachers because if they're not sure about something, they'll go home and actually try it in their environments.
Keith, I wanted to ask you, allied to that, but one of the challenges in the industry is burnout. It's a systemic risk. How can leaders build a culture that treats the mental resilience of the cyber team as a real tier one necessary business asset?
In some ways, with some organizations, just making the environment a safe environment for people to ask questions. Get them out the door and have them do something. Get the team sometimes to go out and go do an event, go to lunch sometime or whatever else. Try to get them out of the environment a little bit so that they're not being stressed. I've noticed some places around here will actually take them in and spend some time doing like volleyball or some sort of sport. Might even take them to a rock climbing place or whatever. Just getting them out and in the non-work environment sometimes will help them.
And I think it's hugely important. I think if we're talking about using things like AI to improve performance, we're talking about people who are passionate about what they do. And very often they can spend too long in that technical environment. So as you've rightly pointed out, they're just taking them out of it to do something different, brings that sense of perspective, improves the view, and indeed in the instances you've just highlighted there, improves the team working as well. And for people listening to this, that's hugely important. Because when you get to a breach situation or some kind of challenge in the workplace, you need people who are actually on it from the get-go. You don't have time for them to then ramp up. And so if they are stressed, if they are tired, they're not going to be able to give of their best. So maintaining that balance.
They all know the number one reason for breaches is the human.
Exactly.
So,
Yeah, no, absolutely right.
still, it hasn't changed. So.
No, that's very true. Very true. I want to come back to AI. How do you think we can make sure that as we lean on using AI tools, which are very often not our own within the business, they're owned by third parties, how can we ensure that we don't lose some of that company-based intelligence, if you like, the internal ability to understand and defend our own systems without this sort of black box intermediary? So we've mentioned that it's about how you work with the AI. But some of the concerns that I hear from people are, if I'm sharing all of this information with AI, how do I know that it's not being accessed by somebody else? Or how do I know that it's making the right call on that? So I'm back really into that discussion about the human AI interaction, because that's a hugely important aspect for a lot of companies who want to adopt this for real.
Most of these companies, like whether it's ChatGPT or Gemini or any of them, Amazon Bedrock, they all have a layer now, or a kind of a call it a firewall between your interaction with the AI versus what the underlying AI is. So they don't allow that information to go across the barrier so that it stays with the organization. And I know that a lot of organizations have been very specific in making sure that occurs. The companies have had to figure out ways to make sure that doesn't happen where they're not using that data to help train the models. For an example, there, that data stays separate from the model training that they're actually doing. There's a firewall that has to be there between the using of the environments and also how the models are being trained.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'd add to that that there's no getting away from the fact that before you implement some of these solutions, you need to have really thought through the whole governance aspect of it.
Correct.
Where the data is coming from.
And also understanding the risks, because the biggest issue in cybersecurity are the AI systems that are very vulnerable to attacks and being able to protect those. And we're doing quite a bit of that, trying to teach our students how these models are not as smart as they think they are, because you're sending all this information to the model and the model is doing it working, sending things back. And what they don't realize is that in some cases, there's this context thing where it sends only so much information back and forth. It's adapting as you're communicating with it based on what you send to it. If you don't say anything to it, it's going to give you back generic information. If you give it some context, and it'll actually give you better information back. So that's a big thing.
Back to the point you were making earlier, isn't it?
Yes,
About learning how to
correct.
work with this very powerful tool to get the best from it on both sides. Keith, it's been great talking to you. I want to finish up with just one question. We started talking about the CEO. Let's finish talking about the CEO. If you're advising a chief executive today on their, say, 5-year talent roadmap, what's the one obsolete role they should stop hiring for? And what is the one emerging role they haven't even thought about yet?
That's a good question. There are so many experts that say that anything that can be automated, I mean, it actually might be just simple as administrative assistants or whatever else, or even some cases financial analysts or any types of things that have a lot of technology involved that can actually augment a lot of that. The type of person you need to look at is the person who's able to use AI to do the job that you need them to be able to do better and faster and be more efficient at it. What you got to be careful of is the people that are going to be obsolete are the ones that are basically fighting the AI and not using AI at all to help them, because that is pretty much they are going to be dinosaurs if they're not already dinosaurs. So you've got to look at the big picture of the person holistically and say, okay, how are you using the AI to do your work? How are you using it to solve problems? How are you doing? So you got to ask them those types of questions. I think what's going to happen is the AI is going to probably create a whole new different class of workers in a lot of ways. And so and CEOs need to look at going into the future, okay, how is the AI going to improve what my bottom line and what we're doing and what my vision is, what I'm planning for the future, and how can those people that have those AI skills help them get to that point?
I think it again supports a view that I've always had is that AI, if you look at it holistically, is not necessarily going to get rid of jobs.
Yes,
It's actually going to create other jobs,
they
and
will be.
they will be different. I think that's the bottom line. They will be different. And if I were giving that advice, I would be saying you've got to really understand the transferable skills of your people. You've got to be investing in upskilling them, in training them, in helping to make that transition. So actually, you're not making clear-cut decisions about we're getting rid of this block of people and we need to hire that block of people. Could you transition them across and perhaps use AI to help with that?
And it's really about creativity and innovation, right?
Right.
You're as an employer and you're looking at basically where you're going to be in the future. It's about innovating and being creative and creating new innovations for what you're doing, whatever that is. How are you going to be more efficient and actually compete in the marketplace? And that the way to do it is through innovation.
Absolutely.
And I think in a lot of ways, the AI stuff is going to help us be able to become more creative and innovate more, because it can actually fill in some of the blanks that you might be missing or something you didn't think about.
Right. Fantastic. Hopefully, there's plenty for people to think about listening to this conversation. Keith, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time and sharing some of those insights with our listeners. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more expert insights and thought-provoking discussions. But in the meantime, if you really enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate, review, and share the podcast. If you're interested in becoming an ISEF member or continuing the conversation further, please do get in touch with me at steve.durbin@securityforum.org, or indeed get hold of me on LinkedIn. And remember, you can explore all our media and resources at our website, securityforum.org.